By the spring of 1865, the Union armies ranged at will across the South. The Civil War was all but over, but resistance remained strong. And no city or town was more defiant than Richmond, the Confederate capital. As our guest this week, Nelson Langford, points out, the capture and burning of Richmond did not win the war for the Union, but it did represent the final crushing blow to the Confederacy. It also sowed the seeds of resentment that Southerners harbored toward the North for the next 100 years. Nelson Langford is the author of Richmond Burning, The Last Days of the Confederate Capital, published by Penguin Books. Welcome, Nelson.
Glad to be here, Brian.
Well, thanks for joining us. Let me start with an obvious question, or at least I think it is, which is, why did the Confederacy choose as its capital a city so close to Union lines rather than a more protected, deeper South?
Well, it was indeed only 100 miles from the Union capital, but you have to remember, the Confederacy began as the secession of the Deep South states, which had very little industry and only a small portion of the total white population of the South. And they wanted to get the Upper South states to join them. So one thing to do would be to offer to move the capital to Richmond, which was the most industrial city in the South. And that helped appeal to the secessionists in the Upper South. And, of course, it gave the Confederacy an industrial base it didn't have before. But it put the capital within striking distance of Washington, but vice versa.
So there was no dissension in the ranks and in the Deep South to have Richmond so far north and being a commercial city.
Well, there were other contenders wanting to be the capital, but I think the Southerners realized that in order to gain the adherence of those Upper South states, they were willing to have Richmond the capital of the Confederacy.
Okay. And what was the impact, then, of choosing Richmond to become the capital?
Well, for the people of Richmond, it dramatically changed life. Richmond was a city of about 40,000 people before the war, and it almost tripled in size during the war with a massive influx of government bureaucrats and contractors and soldiers, lots of strangers. It changed the city dramatically. People didn't know who their neighbors were anymore.
Well, I want to come back to the impact on life, especially at the end of the war, but let me ask you first sort of one of these obvious questions. Why did it take so long, or perhaps another way of putting it, how come the capital survived for so long when it was so close to Union lines?
Well, it looks like a short distance as the crow flies, but there are lots of rivers between Washington and Richmond, and there was a lot of fighting that was away from Virginia for a long time. Some people would say the war is actually won in the West as the Union forces opened the Mississippi to their side and closed it to the Confederates. But as the war wore on, you can see the battles inching closer and closer to Richmond.
Do you think Grant had any choice? Could he have just ordered a full-scale assault on the city in the early months of, say, 65?
Grant, he was interested in crushing the armies opposed to him rather than taking territory, and so he was angling to defeat Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia. It just happened that he cornered Lee in the Central Virginia area, and there was a siege around Richmond and Petersburg, which was a small town below Richmond. So Grant was after the Confederate Army more than he was the capital, and Richmond happened to be there. My story takes place in Richmond. What happened in Richmond at the end of the war? The military action was sort of off stage from the focus of my story. Grant and Lee fighting it out below Richmond. And then Richmond becomes, as the Confederate Army leaves, then Richmond is open to occupation by the Union Army. There wasn't a lot of fighting between soldiers in the taking of Richmond.
Okay, so then let's deal with that, life in Richmond. First, tell us about how life in Richmond changed toward the end of the war before it finally fell.
Before the city fell, people were beginning to feel the pinch. Even the most diehard Confederates could see in daily life that although no one starved, people were hungry, and the variety of supplies and food that came in diminished, and life was hard. They're actually jumping ahead a bit, one of the Union officers remarked when he came into the city that people are glad to see us here, not so much from any Union sentiment, but because they've suffered so much. And that was true. Whether they were diehard Confederates or secret Union sympathizers. People were worn down with privation by April of 1865.
Okay. Now, one of the final blows is clearly when Lee's defeated at Fort Stedman, and then he abandons the city. And on April 2nd, Confederate President Jefferson Davis and members of his government flee as well. But you have an interesting story about one person who stays behind, John Campbell. In fact, I found this probably one of the more interesting parts of the book. Could you tell us a little bit about him and what he did?
John Campbell was a fascinating person. He had been an Associate Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court before the Civil War. He had actually tried to negotiate between the Confederates and the Lincoln government to prevent war from breaking out in April of 1861, and he failed, of course. Then he joined the Confederacy, became the Assistant Secretary of War under Jefferson Davis, and was the highest-ranking Confederate official left in Richmond when the Confederates left and the Union Army marched in. Campbell actually met Abraham Lincoln in Richmond and tried to negotiate with him because, you know, Lincoln arrived in Richmond only a day after the Union Army occupied it. And there was John Campbell trying to negotiate from a position of weakness. He encouraged Lincoln to call the Virginia legislature into session, and Lincoln agreed to do that. His purpose was to call the Virginia legislature together just to take Virginia out of the Confederacy and hasten the end to the war. But Lincoln almost tripped up here because he was giving Confederate officials some sort of recognition by allowing the legislature to convene. Nothing, of course, came of this. Appomattox happened before anything could happen. But it was a fascinating little diplomatic incident between John Campbell and Abraham Lincoln in the week after Richmond fell.
It really is very interesting, and clearly one of the strengths of this book is your descriptive power. I mean, it's a history, but it comes across so well in vivid imagery, and I think one area that, or one particular part you might want to talk about, and you have Richmond falling, the city's burning, there's chaos in the city, and in comes the Union troops. Tell us about the entrance of the Union troops.
There was a small Union army east of Richmond, and it was designated with the task of occupying Richmond. On the day the city fell, the Confederate rear guard, under orders, set fire to government-owned tobacco in a few warehouses by the waterfront, and they set fire to the last bridges across the James River. Unfortunately for them, a stiff wind arose and blew the fires out of control and destroyed the business district of the city just as the advanced regiments of the Union Army came in. There are lots of stories, fascinating stories, about that day. There's a story of the rivalry between black and white Union regiments to try to be the first to enter Richmond. There was a story about who really raised the first American flag over the Capitol. And, of course, there were lots of claimants for that. And the story of who the last Confederates were to march across the last bridge before it burned across the river. It was a chaotic day and a fearful day for the residents. Even the minority who welcomed the Union Army, it was a frightening time to see their city burn.
Enter Lincoln the next day. Pretty gutsy move. Why did he do it again, and what was the response to his arrival?
Now, Lincoln was close at hand. He wasn't in Washington. A few weeks before, he wanted to meet with his commander, General Grant, and Grant's headquarters was at a place called City Point, which is now Hopewell, Virginia, which is a few miles downstream from Richmond. So he was on the spot when, in a sense, all hell broke loose and Grant's army began to follow Lee's army as it retreated to the west. Lincoln knew that the city of Richmond had fallen, but he and his advisors didn't know if it was militarily secure. But he still wanted to see the city. So he boarded a gunboat, and in fact he went with a flotilla of gunboats from City Point for the few miles upriver to Richmond. But one by one, the gunboats had engine trouble, or they ran into obstructions, or they were just too big to get by Confederate barriers in the river. Lincoln just wanted to continue, and he progressively moved from larger to smaller boats till he ended up coming to Richmond in an admiral's barge, really just a big rowboat. And his security detail was left behind, wringing their hands, standing on the decks of their gunboats as the president disappeared upriver. You can imagine what would happen to the Secret Service today. So there he is, Abraham Lincoln, arriving in Richmond to the burned waterfront, and very quickly a crowd of African-American freedmen crowd around him and salute him and cheer him as he marches around the burn district and up through town to Jefferson Davis's mansion, which is, he knew at that point, that was going to be where the Union general in command would have his headquarters. And so Lincoln marches to Davis's house and sits in Jefferson Davis's chair maybe 36 hours after the Confederate president had left. Very dramatic stuff.
Dramatic indeed. You make a point that the burning of Richmond marked the beginning of the romanticization of the Old South and its ideals. What was that viewpoint, and how romanticized versus historical reality was it?
Well, one of the things you have to remember is that we have a wonderful visual record of the ruins of Richmond. There were photographers and journalists with the Union Army who came in shortly thereafter and began to take pictures and sell them as souvenirs to Northerners, mainly. Those images of Richmond in ruins signified loss to the South and failed rebellion to the North for decades after the Civil War. So Richmond became a symbol, and all of the hurt and anguish that the Southern people felt at the defeat of their cause, in a sense, a repository for that would be to focus on, look at what happened to Richmond. There were people, even before the ashes had cooled, who were making arguments about how the South was crushed by superior military force, and vowed that America would never be unified. In fact, the day after Richmond burned, an editor in Chicago said something, I can't remember exactly the quotation, but he said something like, the future unity of America will date from the 3rd of April when the Union flag was planted on the battlements of Richmond. Well, when that Chicago editor wrote that, the last Confederate newspaper in Richmond said something like this. He said, the editor said, after what has happened for the past 4 years, the future unity of America is a dream of maniacs. And that was the sentiment of a lot of diehard Confederates for a long time. And it took a long time, and it took a lot of selective forgetting and remembering on both sides before that unity came about. But thank God it did, because who would today object to that unity? But it was a long time in coming for generations.
Right. Clearly. And that really does sum it up. I think those were two great quotes, and including yours as well. We don't have time to go into it, but anyone starting to read your book will be struck, I think, as well by your very vivid portrayal of Robert E. Lee's return to Richmond. You actually start your book with it, but it really takes place at the end. And you want to very quickly comment on that?
Well, Lee came back to Richmond, I think it was 6 days after Appomattox, the 15th of April, 1865. And remember, this was the first view he had of Richmond in ruins. He hadn't seen the evacuation or the fire because he was retreating with his army earlier. This was the first view he had of the ruins of the capital city. And he arrived... when he arrived, people came out on the streets and began to wave to him, and gradually more and more people came out on the streets. When he reached his home, or the house that his family was renting, the crowd asked him to give a speech, but he refused to, and he went inside.
Interesting.
And the people in the crowd didn't know it, but the very time that they were saluting Lee, the Union military had received word over the telegraph that Lincoln had been shot the night before. So it was a very dramatic moment in the history of Richmond.
Great. And I'm afraid that's where we'll have to end it, but thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Nelson Lankford, the author of Richmond Burning, The Last Days of the Confederate Capital, published by Penguin Books. And this is Talking History.